Good Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a great start so far. 10:06 is the time right now. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Got a science question for us this morning. It is time this hour for another edition of Science Files. And joining me this morning, St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker. And I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, our first open hour of the week is coming up. We call it Manic Monday, and as always, anything goes. This morning, again, between 11 and 12. And after the news at noon, City Councilor Steve Craig, who also chairs HRM's Board of Police Commissioners, will bring us up to speed on the hunt for a new police chief. Down to one candidate, we're told, but it could be weeks yet before there's an announcement. And Blair is still overseas. He's attending or attended the weekend convention of the British Titanic Society. Military historian John Below will join me this afternoon with a Halifax history moment for us. But this hour, let's welcome St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker to the studio for another edition of Science Files. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you doing this morning, sir?
Pretty good. It's a bit foggy out there this morning, especially after the beautiful day we had yesterday.
What a gorgeous day
it
was yesterday. Great. Yeah, I was out raking out in the backyard, and I'm feeling awfully stiff right now.
You're out raking because you didn't rake in the fall?
No.
It's better then. It's not normally quite as moldy.
I know. But, you know, things happen. You get busy, and poof, then it snows, and then
stuff happens.
Too late.
Right, yeah, I know. Stuff happens.
But anyway, it was a beautiful day, no question. Yeah. Gorgeous day yesterday, and hopefully, as we head to towards May and June, we'll see a whole lot more
of that. Yeah, it's looking like we've probably... Yeah. Well, I'm not going to jinx it. I won't say anything.
Good.
Everyone's going to tease me for saying I could jinx something. But anyway, let's not worry about that.
Been out on the golf course yet?
No, because I play at Oakfield, and they won't be open for probably until the beginning of May. Yeah.
Some are already open, though. So.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the black hole photo here. This is something we touched on last week, and... scientists, a group of scientists, astronomers and such, use the Event Horizon Telescope and for the very first time have photographed a black hole. And what's the significance of this, Doctor, other than now we now see this hole in space?
But isn't that significant?
Well, I guess.
But so that's actually what I love about it the most, to be honest. I mean, we can do science with it. But as I've said in a few interviews now, I mean, the main concern we have is that this is like the very first time we've done it. And so the quality of the image that we've got is, it's okay, and we can do some science from it. But the things that we really want to know are what's the environment around the black hole? And to do that really well, we actually need more resolution in the image. And so right now, we're not sure sort of like the bright things that make up the donut. We're not quite sure exactly what that is. We have an idea, but we need a better sort of image to really zoom in and try and figure out more of those details. So it's a really awesome first step. And I do love the fact that, yay, we have a picture of a black hole. Finally, everyone says, well, it's not the black hole, it's just the shadow. Yes, it's just the shadow, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the point, right? And so will it convince everyone out there that black holes exist? There's still going to be some people who won't be buying into it. But as far as I'm concerned, if you've ever wondered what does it look like to see a black hole and the area around a black hole, now you have the image.
Well, I'm looking here at a story. It says, what is a black hole? And it says, black hole is an object in space so dense and has such strong gravity that no matter or light can escape its pull. Because no light can escape, it is black and invisible. And then it goes on to say, if black holes are invisible, how can we detect or photograph them?
Well, so we're taking a picture of the area around the black hole that also includes the black hole. So what you wind up having is, because of the reason that light can't come out from it, then the black hole itself is always going to look dark, yeah?
Yeah.
But there's stuff around it, right?
The light.
Exactly. So it means that there's always going to be light coming from around it. It's going to be warped by the space around the black hole, because that is always warped by the gravity of the black hole. And so although it looks like a really simple image, it's actually phenomenally complicated, right? Because you've got within that shadow of the black hole, you actually have an infinite number of copies that repeat out to the edge of what the event horizon of the black hole would look like if you could see it. But you can't see it, so it's dark. I know. So everything is a contradiction when we talk about this. So, but anyway, it's very, very cool. There should be something called the photon ring, sort of like the innermost ring around the black hole.
It's like the ring around the sun.
That's sort of limb brightening. I mean, it's not... It's slightly different, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, so we can't really see that properly on this image, I think. So we need more resolution. How are we going to get more resolution? Radio telescopes in space.
Okay, yeah. So, and they're working on that, right?
So they've actually done it before. And so we can do this. They're putting a proposal together, which will be in a paper that's coming out within the next 2 weeks. And so then that would extend out the size of the telescope, because right now it's limited by the size of the Earth. Right? Whereas if we can put a radio telescope out in space, then we can make it bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, I think they're probably going to want to put more than one out in space as well. Right? So anyway, we'll see. Because because this is a telescope that's made by connecting different telescopes together, the more different connections you have between the different telescopes, the better the quality of the image you get at the end. So if you put more telescopes into it, you get a better image at the end.
Okay. Right. Now, this particular black hole is 50 million light years away from Earth. But I understand that there's also a black hole within the Milky Way galaxy. Isn't that not closer? Would it have been easier?
Yeah, that one's about 1,000 times closer.
Would it have been easier to photograph that as opposed to this one 50 million light years away?
Excellent question. So they've kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit on this one. And so the thing that's really different between the two is one is essentially 1,000 times bigger than the other in mass. And it turns out that the really, really big one that we have the image for, that's evolving fairly slowly over the period of a few hours that we were able to take the data to take this image. Whereas the one in our galaxy seems to be evolving much faster than that. So it's almost like they can't take a picture of it because it's evolving too quickly. You kind of get,
evolving.
For want of a better term...
What do you mean evolving?
Are happening around the black hole. Stuff is moving around the black hole. Yeah. And so it's moving very quickly. So what people are saying is maybe it's cool enough that they're making a movie of this or something like that. So we'll wait and see. They had 4 days worth of data on the big one, and there were some differences from one day to another, not really big ones. But the suggestion is that the Milky Way black hole is actually changing quite rapidly. So we'll wait and see. It could be they're just sandbagging. They're taking it like, oh, no, nothing to see there. We don't have anything. Then they go, ta-da! We've got this amazing result, but I guess we'll wait and see.
And are we at any... I mean, these black holes are the one in our galaxy, for example. I mean, these things are scooping up, eating, if you want, whatever's in their
way. Things are just falling in. That's the way to think about it. Things are just falling in.
So there's no risk of our planets being...
No, they're not giant vacuum cleaners. They don't go around and go...
Good to hear.
Sucking everything up. So we're all okay. So if we turned our sun into a black hole of the same mass, we would carry on orbiting around. We wouldn't be sucked into it.
Okay.
So you're okay. You don't have to worry about it. It's literally the gravity that makes you fall into a black hole, and that's it. So...
All right, 10:14.
Don't lie awake worrying about it.
I will. I can now rest to sleep at nights. And Brian's just given us a call about a black hole question, and and Frank as well with an email comment question regards to black holes. We'll get to you two right after a quick break. It is coming up to 10:15. This is Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker. And if you've got a question for us this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more right after this. 10:17 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob is with us for Science Files here till 11. And if you've got a question for us, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, just like Brian's called here this morning. Morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Hey, Brian.
Good morning, Dr. Rob. I got a quick question for you.
Sure.
Regarding the black hole, the big one.
The big one.
You said it's 50 million light years away, right?
Yep.
So basically what we're seeing, which is amazing, is a black hole that was there 50 million years ago.
That's right.
And I don't know how much we know about black holes, but as matter or whatever gets sucked into it, do they grow?
Yes, they do. Yeah, absolutely.
So basically then that black hole that we're looking at is big, but it should be even bigger right now because it's 50 million years later that it's been growing. So if we were there, it would be way bigger, right?
It would be bigger, but you know what? You're actually asking me a question that's really the research that I do.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So you want to know how much bigger it would be?
Yeah, you said to me only monitored for a couple of hours and we saw some activity.
All right.
How big could it be?
Okay, absolutely. So this is
appreciate it, Brian. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. So this is actually kind of neat because
Stop there because I've got one more similar question here. This is from Colin, who emails. Same thing. He says this was a photo taken 50 million years ago. Mm-hmm. Or he says, does the radio frequency telescope allow us to gather information in more real time?
Oh, no. Okay. So radio waves travel basically because they're the same electromagnetic radiation as light. So they've taken 50 million years as well. But no, in this particular case, yes, absolutely. We were looking at it as it was 50 million years ago. And the question is, if they're going around, basically, things are falling in, can it accrete more material and get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger? And yes, it is. But here's the thing. Although it's in a really, really massive galaxy, what that black hole has done over a period of a few billion years is to literally blow away a lot of the gas between stars, the interstellar medium, as we call it, which would be the material that collapses down to form gas cloud stars and so on that fall into the black hole. So you're essentially left with what is what we call a giant elliptical galaxy. There's a little bit of gas left in it, but in general, the stars don't want to fall into the black hole. They kind of just loop around it, keeping on going. Every now and again, one will fall in fairly rarely. And there is still some material falling into the black hole, but it's not what we would call accreting at a particularly high rate. So if you were to say it's 50 million years ago, it was 6.5 billion solar masses, what would its mass be? It would have changed by a fraction of a percent. It really wouldn't have grown that much because it's not at a stage where it's going to grow a lot. What would make it grow a lot is if another galaxy merged with the one it's in and then deposited a whole lot of new gas that could actually fall in. And so we study this directly, looking for galaxies that are merging and looking for black hole activity as well. And so that's my research.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so if we saw...
I got a question on my research on there. That's really awesome.
If we saw a picture of that black hole today... It would simply have a similar look, maybe, but maybe
it would probably look pretty much the same, to be honest. I mean, it's 50 million years. It's not that long. I mean, it's not a tiny amount of time in cosmologically speaking. It's still a reasonable amount of time. But at the end of the day, you're probably looking at 2 or 3 billion years to grow significantly.
Mm. Why are there black holes, by the way? What's the purpose of a black hole? Why is a black hole there?
Well, so it's just a property of space and time that you can do this. And so if you have the creation of something that's super, super dense above a certain limit, then gravity just sort of collapses down everything on itself and forms these black holes. It's just the universe we live in.
Yeah, and we have no idea what happens when it goes into a black hole. The things just disappear.
No, we don't. I mean, so that is one of the big questions. What would happen if you went inside a black hole? Are there possibilities of navigating to other space-times through a black hole? Maybe, but you'd never be able to tell anyone.
Because you couldn't come back.
Exactly.
Yeah. Still, it'd be fascinating to somehow try to figure that out.
Wasn't that the plot of Disney's black hole movie?
Oh, probably,
Anyway,
it's certainly the work of science fiction. Yes.
Well, so people have written legitimate scientific papers about this. There's what's called coordinate extensions, which are a part of the theory of general relativity that allow you to describe how the space-time is inside a black hole. And there's always this possibility that there could be connections to other universes. But, you know, it's very speculative and so on. So we don't really know. And we can't really know in this universe, which is the ironic thing, right? We can't actually know.
And this telescope, the Event Horizon Telescope, I mean, how big a telescope is that? How complicated a telescope is that?
That's literally a network of
eight
telescopes
that
covers the whole of the Earth, pretty much. Right. It's not every single bit, but there is lines basically connecting all of these different telescopes in different places that essentially create a telescope that's the size of the Earth. And like I said, if we want to do better observations of these black holes, then we need something that's bigger, and which means going and putting things in space.
Hmm. Pavel just emailed us. This might be a question more suited for Dave Lane, the astronomer at St. Mary's, but he's wondering if I'd ask you what would be a good telescope to buy for kids, and he's curious about the price range. I think we've mentioned this before.
I would defer to Dave. I mean, I know a little bit. But so one of the things is about buying your first telescope is, although a lot of the new computerized ones actually will do a lot of things for you, if you have a manual one, then actually pointing it around the sky and knowing what to look at can be non-trivial. And so a lot of people buy a telescope and get quite disappointed. I would say don't buy one of the really, really cheap ones. That's not going to help you. And if you're seeing a box that says 300 times magnification, don't be sold by that. It's not about magnification. It's literally about the size of the aperture of the telescope. So that's what you want to focus on. And one of the things that we always recommend to people is if you like stars and you want to look at stars, get some really good binoculars.
Yeah,
exactly, because you get both of your eyes seeing at the same time, and it gives you a much better visual impression, particularly with star clusters and so on. So,
but for planets, the telescope
for planets, you really do need a telescope. And so if you want to do that, particularly, but even things like Saturn, that looks really good through a fairly small telescope. You don't need something huge for that. And there is this thing called atmospheric seeing as well, that after you get beyond a certain point, then things don't get better result. In fact, when anyone who's looked through a telescope of any size will know that when you look through, you can see the ripples in the atmosphere from all of the motions of the caused by the different densities of air and motions of the air.
So, oh, neat. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones, and June's on the line. Good morning, June.
Good morning. How are you this morning,
Rick? We're doing great. Thanks very much.
Wonderful. Okay, I have a question, and it's with regard to something that Jim Bridenstine at the Space Symposium disclosed.
Okay.
Okay, he said that they detected water below the surface of Mars 12 kilometers deep. Okay, here's my thought on this. Good science is observable, testable, to be able to, you know, come up with an answer. And my question is this, that if on the Earth, the furthest we were ever able to dig down, and you can research this as I have done, is 8 miles. If we can go no further than 8 miles down on our own Earth, where we have all of the technologies, all of the tools at our disposal, can you explain for me, Mr. Thacker, how they were able to go 12 kilometers down on the surface of Mars and determine that there was liquid? And I researched this, and I'm trying to find the answer of how they came up with that figure of 12 kilometers below the surface of Mars.
All right.
As to this date, I have not been able to come up with where Jim Bridenstine was able to give this information with no background for how they came to this information.
All right.
I will just hang up and listen to the answer, and I thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate the call, June. Thanks very much.
So I can't comment on the 12 kilometers. I didn't think it was 12 kilometers, but I don't know. I'd have to look it up on the internet. But I do know the techniques that they're using, and so they're using subsurface radar. Right, and that's what they're doing, and so you can use this on the. I believe they've actually found.
So they haven't actually dug 12.
No. They've sent radar down. It will bounce off different densities and so on, and it will backscatter all the way back up, and then you look at that backscattered signal and try and figure out what that's coming from. That's not a trivial thing to do, of course. So you talk to geoscientists, they'll tell you that that's pretty difficult. So, I actually thought it was about sort of like 1.5 or 2 kilometers or something like that. I hadn't heard 12. But again, like I said, without looking it up on the internet, I can't give you a straight answer to that. But it is ground-penetrating radar, which we do use. I mean, we've used it over Antarctica for actually finding subsurface lakes there as well. So it's the same kind of technology as far as I'm aware.
We've used it, Jonathan Fowler at St. Mary's, the archaeologist, he's used it to determine what's below the ground of the public gardens, for example. But again... So
they're not digging is the short answer. Yeah. They're actually using ground-penetrating radar.
All right. Brian, stay there. You're coming up. We've got Tim on hold as well, and the lines are open, too. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're going to take a quick break, though, for a news update. Then we're here back with more with Dr. Rob in Science Falls. We're back after the news, and the news is coming up next. Star Wars. You're not a Star Wars fan, though, are you? You're a Star Trek fan, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't mind Star Wars. I like it. It's fun stories. Obviously, when I was growing up as a kid, it was a big part of my life. But I prefer the contemplative, smart look on things that Star Trek often has. Although, of course, a lot of Star Trek people like the Klingons. But anyway.
So what are we at now? Star Trek, I think there's Star Trek Discovery is the latest. I've seen the first series,
but I haven't seen the second series. Apparently, the second series is meant to be better.
I really like the original Star Trek with Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk.
Captain Spock.
I like Star Trek The Next Generation, but I kind of lost interest after that.
There's been a lot of spin-offs, hasn't there? So, I guess, I think my favorite spinoff was actually probably Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, it was not bad, but again, Star Trek, the original, and Star Trek, the Next Generation were classics.
So good.
Yes, indeed. All right, to the phones are going. Brian's on the line. Morning, Brian.
Hi. I might have the esoteric question of the week.
Okay. All right, we're anxious to hear it.
What would happen, or can it happen, can two black holes come in contact with each other? Does the big one swallow up the smaller one, or do they repel, or what would happen?
And is there that a possibility that
An
could happen?
Excellent question, okay. I may say.
All right. So, let's hear the answer.
So what I'm going to say is I'm going to cast it in a slightly different way. So does the big one swallow up the small one? Does the small one swallow up the big one? It doesn't really matter. What actually happens is the two of them will merge together. And so black hole mergers is a key area of research because as they come together, they have so much. So if we take sort of like two black holes, and I'm going to use something from, do you remember there was all this talk about detecting gravitational waves about 2 years ago? That was so incredible because that was the signal from two black holes actually merging together.
And it really happened. Okay.
Oh, yeah. This is happening probably every day somewhere in the universe somewhere. And so they come together and literally you've got things that weigh 30 times the mass of the sun in some cases, but they're overall size is just a few kilometers in diameter. But here's the thing, they're rotating around one another at a significant fraction of the speed of light, right? And they're converting all of this energy as they're rotating around one another, or not all of it, they're releasing a lot of it in gravitational energy that goes out in ripples in space and time, and then we can detect them with the LIGO detectors. So yeah, that's a great question. It happens. And we are already detecting those signals from those events.
Good question, Bob. Brian.
All right. Can I ask a sort of related one quickly?
If you got $50, okay.
You take half, right?
Do scientists, like, is it possible or is it some science fiction that our universe could be inside of another one and da-da-da-da like that?
Okay. So there's often a lot of talk of whether the universe has properties such that we are kind of like a piece that's pinched off relative to another universe or something
like string theory?
A little bit? Not quite. It's related to something called the inflationary theory. And so that's a possibility. But the thing is, when that sort of like separation happens, there's a huge amount of energy released and we couldn't get the additional information that we want to know about those other universes. So we can't ever really know is the honest answer. But people have certainly thought about this is quite legitimate. And there are some really quite important theories in physics talking about this kind of thing. But there's a lot of different ideas as well that come into this. There's also the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics and so on, which is a bit different. That's more kind of like parallel universes, but not really. So anyway, lots of different things. And I know Mark Hodgins was talking about lying away and worrying about this at night.
Yeah,
so.
There you go. Appreciate the question, Brian. Thank you.
All
right, bye-bye. Mark just emailed wondering what happens to time within a black hole. Does time slow up or slow down or speed up, he wonders.
Yeah, so it all depends who's looking at it. So if you're the person who's going into the black hole, then time always goes pretty much the same for you. However, if you're looking down on a black hole at someone who's falling into that black hole, it will look to you from far away as if their time is slowing down, right? But it's a weird thing that with relativity tells you that different observers see time pass at different rates. And so for you, if you had your spacecraft and you were falling into the black hole, your time would still pass as normal. But for the people who were outside the gravity of the black hole, they would see your time as going more slowly.
Really? Yeah. We got all kinds of black hole questions here popping up on email. This is from Evan, who says he has two questions. First one, he says, in time, if the black hole gets big enough, could it suck us in like pulling a plug in a tub full of water? My other question is, he writes, are there any plans to send some kind of camera in to see where it goes or do things that does it just get destroyed if it gets sucked in?
Okay, let's give everyone something that they can tell their kids and have a good laugh about it.
All right.
Black holes don't suck.
Okay.
All right. So this is a big thing. Black holes are not sucking.
We should make some kind of pin with that. Black holes don't suck.
Yeah. In fact, they blow. Which is actually true because they have material falling around them, the accretion disk, which lets off a lot of radiation pressure. But anyway, No, you don't need to worry about it. Even though we have this sort of like 4 or 5 million solar mass black hole in the middle of our galaxy, that's not something that's going to suck us in or anything like that. Technically, if there was a black hole that was close and we weren't moving at a fast enough speed, yes, we could fall into it. But there's nothing around us. Really, don't worry about it. Don't lie awake. And so the idea of what would happen if you put a camera in, I love it. And wouldn't it be great, yes, if we could put a camera into a black hole, although we can never get to a black hole. They're too far away.
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, if we could put one in, the problem is once you put it in there, you can't beam a signal out. If you used a cable, the cable would break. There's nothing you could do to get a signal out of a black hole. I'm sorry, as fun as it sounds like it, yes, everyone wants to do it. It's actually really incredibly, basically impossible.
So read a piece of science fiction if you want to basically to hear someone's interpretation of what happened.
So in a big enough black hole, like the one, the M87 one that we got the image of last week, you could go through the event horizon of that black hole. Once you've done that, your future is not good because you are destined eventually to go to the singularity in the middle and actually be crushed by that singularity. But you could still go in and you could see what it was like to be inside the black hole event horizon. But it's not like something says, bing, 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 you have passed the event horizon. You just keep on going. You don't know, but people outside do, right?
Patrick emails, there was some speculation before the photo was released that the black hole image may shed light on quantum gravity. Did this image help with that, if at all? If not, what were we hoping to see to help with a theory of quantum gravity?
That's actually the first I've heard about this particular image having any possible quantum effects. So one of the big, big unknowns in physics is how you reconcile the theory of quantum mechanics, which is the very small, with the theory of gravity, which is the very big. We don't know how to do that. We've been working on that for a very long time. String theory, membrane theory, they might be a way to do that. We don't know. It's like 22nd century mathematics. We're still trying to figure out what's going on there. So in short, I haven't heard anything about that. If I'm not sure what kind of quantum effects there would be. In this case, there could be sort of this thing called Hawking radiation. That's a quantum effect around a black hole. But I don't think anyone was expecting to see any signature of Hawking radiation. I don't know how, because all of the signals from all of the stuff that was falling in would presumably swamp that by significant orders of magnitude. So I don't know is the short answer. I haven't heard anything anyone talk about. That doesn't mean someone didn't have some kind of idea there. I don't know.
All right. Kyle with a question from email. He wonders, what are gravitational waves? Are they ripples in the fabric of space-time?
He's answered his own question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they are. So right. It's kind of difficult to think about what they really are. But what they do to the particular detectors is that there are two detectors that measure the distance between two points in one direction and in another direction that are 90 degrees to one another. As they come through, you'll see the space and time gets very slightly, we're talking like fractions of the width of an atom. This is just ridiculously small. Fractions of the width of a nucleus of an atom. And so we see that very, very slight change and we measure that. But these are tiny, tiny changes. It was the width of a hair in the space between stars.
Oh, really? Wow.
Right? It's so incredibly minuscule. It's taken us like 50 years to come up with the technology to even be able to do that.
Kyle, with the second part to his question, how big is the singularity compared to the event horizon?
Oh, so I think so. The singularity is the point in the middle. And so arguably with that, you would say that it is infinitely small. But we know that that can't actually be true. There is another theory. And so then it would be on what's called the Planck scale, which is incredibly small, ridiculously small. I can't give you the number off the top of my head. It's probably like 10 to the minus 42 meters or something like that. And it's much, 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 much smaller than the event horizon, which for the M87 black hole would be well out beyond the orbit of Pluto. Right. The point of the singularity is it's essentially this thing that's incredibly tiny. Right. And so it's where quantum mechanics would come in. So. Yeah, I should remember what the Planck length is, but I can't.
All right.
I can look it up.
Another black hole question. This is from Rob, who says, wondering if we could set up a network of satellites or telescopes on the moon and to look at or look into black holes.
So it's certainly not a bad idea to put a radio telescope on the moon. That's something that people are actively looking at.
Yeah.
So what the idea there would be, to put it on the far side of the moon.
Why?
because then you're shielded from the Earth's radio interference. Yeah, so that's actually something people really, really want to do. It would be exceptionally scientifically productive if we could do that. And so we're talking about... So people have had some ideas that we could deploy dipole antennas, just sort of like deploy them from a thing that was flying around the moon and just drop them down. But power is always going to be an issue and so on. But so, yes, that would be a sensible idea, a very, very expensive thing to do, of course. And it would also, if we were talking about an interferometer, then you could have a baseline that was the Earth-Moon distance, and that would be very cool as well. But again, it's just a question of cost in all of these things.
Yeah, they are talking about it. I'm not sure what states are building a space station around the moon, right?
Yeah, the Deep Space Gateway. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So
that would be more of a lab.
A lunar gateway, as it's called now.
That'd be more of a lab than any kind of telescope facility.
That's possibly.
Really?
We might talk about putting telescopes on there, but it's questionable whether that's a good place to put. Because there's humans there, which means there's radio signals. So if it's a radio telescope, you don't want to be polluted by someone turning on the microwave and you don't know, because that actually has happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There was a story of a radio telescope in Australia, the Parkes radio telescope, I believe, where they had these weird signals and they didn't know what they were. And so this was related to the fast radio burst thing that we've talked about.
Okay, yeah.
And so it turns out these, I think they were called Peritons or something like that. It was someone turning on the microphone.
That
annoyed a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. 10:45 is our time here on this Monday morning. This is Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. In fact, a question here from a caller, and ponder this for a moment while we take a break. Caller wants to know, when did you realize, Dr. Rob, you wanted to become an astrophysicist? And have you always been interested in space? We'll get Dr. Rob to answer that question when we come back after this quick break. 10:48 is our time here on a Monday morning, Science Files with Dr. Rob till 11. And how about that question? When did you realize you wanted to become an astrophysicist? And have you always been interested in space?
Grab a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Let's sit around the fire and talk about my life story. So, I grew up I was born just after the Apollo landing.
Uh-huh.
So I grew up as a kid. Mum would put me in front of the TV probably when I was 18, two and a half and so on. And Apollo seemed like it was playing all the time. And so I just remember the Eagle Has Landed, that whole piece, and that's etched in my brain. And so... then when I was 4 or 5, my dad would read to me about what they were doing and trips to space and so on. And we talk about it around the family dinner table as well. And so I was always kind of interested in it. As I got older, my dad was an engineer. So he was super practical. And even though I was quite good at a few sports, he was like, oh, don't play sports, stay in school. And so I studied and thought I was going to be a computer engineer or something like that.
Yeah.
And then, as it turned out, one of my friend's dads was a physicist who'd been to Cambridge, and he was now actually working for a fisheries laboratory because he was a mathematician. And so he gave me a book about string theory. And I read that, and I think I was about 15 or 16, and now I was like, oh, this is good. This is cool. I want to do this. And so I was really good at math, and I was pretty darn good at physics as well. So I decided that was what I was going to do, and I was still doing my sports, so I went to university to be on in a sports team as well. And then when I got there, I realized I couldn't do sports and I had to work on my subjects a bit harder. And I just kind of kept on going at it. And I was good enough in the first year. I wasn't the best by quite a long shot in the first year. But by the second, third, fourth year, I was like, wow, I'm actually pretty good at this. And there weren't really many people better than I was. In fact, the only person who was probably better than I was went to work with a guy called Roger Penrose, very famous mathematician at Oxford. And so then I went to graduate school. I did pretty well at that, doing a master's degree in London, and took a year out working. But after that, thought, I'm going to go do my PhD and see how it goes. And so every time I've been prepared to go and do something else if it didn't work out. There's hard work in there, but there's probably an element of luck there too, that it's just all worked out for me. And so I've always really sort of like cared about speaking to the public. So one of the things I did when I was a graduate student at the University of Alberta, because I came to Canada to do my PhD, was actually organize some public lectures.
Yeah.
Right. So I've always had this thing about talking to the public. But I've been super lucky. I never I never really thought I'd get a career doing this. And a lot of people think, or they have their plan out, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and that's what I'm going to do. But I never did. I always thought, because I took a year out, I'd worked in merchant banking, actually, that I could go back and do that, earn a lot of money. It was kind of boring, but I still earned a lot of money doing it. And so, yeah, I feel really blessed.
Well, good. Good for you. Yeah. So you're reading string theory books at the age of 15.
I was.
I'm trying to remember what I was reading at the age of 15. It was nowhere close to that.
Well, it was just a book, the popular book about it. But no, it was actually, it wasn't string. It was Super Gravity by Paul Davies, I think it was.
I'm kind of, Catcher in the Rye comes to mind, but that's about all I can recall from back in those days.
Yep.
J.D.
Salinger.
Thank you very much.
I made myself read that because there was so much talk about it.
Mm. Let's go to Bonita on the line. She's got a question for us this morning. Hi, Bonita.
Hey, gentlemen. My question is, why didn't they pick the closest black hole to us, the one in our solar system? And how exactly do you know when you run into one?
All right. Okay. Thank you, Bonita.
Okay. So the good news is, Bonita, we don't have one in our solar system, thankfully. Okay. So don't worry about that. It's the one in our galaxy, which is still a very, very long way away. Don't worry about it. It's not going to do anything to us. And it's a good question.
Yeah, why didn't pick that
they?
One?
Why
yeah.
didn't they? So we kind of hinted at this earlier, that they've sort of said unofficially that the one in our galaxy is quite a lot smaller than the other one, but it's closer to us, so we can still see it. But it's changing very quickly because it's a comparatively small one as these supermassive ones go. And so what they're suggesting is it's been really, really difficult to get an image from it, right? And so because it's moving and changing shape, it's a little bit like camera blur, if you want, give a sort of like similar idea that when sometimes you take a picture and everything's blurry, there seems to be a suggestion that things are changing so rapidly around this black hole that it's literally incredible. And if that's the case, then maybe what we'll be able to see down the line is actually a movie of how things are changing, which is even more exciting than just a picture. Mm. And so the second part of the question was, how would you know? If it was a small black hole, you would literally be, this is a technical term, spaghettified. You would be stretched out by the tidal forces as you fell in. So that would be incredibly painful way to die, and I wouldn't recommend that. But again, they're a very long way away, so don't worry. And the other thing is, if it was a really, really big black hole, like the one in M87, then you literally wouldn't know when you'd gone through the event horizon, but you'd still be spaghettified eventually once you fell to the singularity in the middle.
Be nice to send a camera in there sometime if we only could.
Yeah, you're still not going to get anything from the camera.
Yeah. I don't know. Just be neat to try.
It doesn't matter what you think. It's what the physics says.
I hear you. Let's talk about completely something different here now. And the first flight of the Strato launcher. I saw this on the TV news last night. Yeah. This looked like two airplanes that have been kind of welded together.
No, it does.
What's the purpose of this thing?
So this is Paul Allen. So you remember Paul Allen was one of the Microsoft co-founders with Bill Gates.
Yep.
And so he was, it's amazing how all of these high-tech guys seem to be space geeks as well. But anyway, so Paul had this idea of, well, not his idea. I'm sure other people pitched him on the idea. But anyway, building a very massive airplane to launch rockets well above the surface of the Earth. There's a few benefits from doing that. Cost savings primarily, because you can make the rocket a little bit less massive and so on. And so this would go up to about 35,000 feet and then launch the rocket up into space from about 35,000 feet. And so it means you need a really massive aircraft. And so this Strato launcher has 117 meters. It's like a football field in the end zone wingspan. And if you look at it, it's absolutely ludicrous. It's literally like two 747s strapped together. That's what it looks like. And so they've done the first flight tests up to about 15,000 feet, two-hour flight, and it seems to work fine. The challenge for them is actually getting a rocket to do regular launches from this. They were going to work with SpaceX, but SpaceX stepped out of it. They were going to develop their own rocket. They've stepped out of it. So they're working with Orbital ATK, who build the Antares, who have the Pegasus launch rocket. But we'll see. I think they need a slightly bigger one than the Pegasus, because Pegasus was launched on a smaller airplane. So they need something bigger than that. And ATK say they will work on something. We'll see where it goes. There's a lot of feeling that it's really uncertain around the funding now that Paul Allen has passed away. So we don't know. But nonetheless, biggest wingspan ever to fly. Yep, pretty incredible.
And now, is the pilot only in one? I mean, they're...
I was wondering the exact same thing. I was like, where is the pilot sitting? And I don't know, because there was three of them. And I don't know whether two were in one and one was in the other one, or whether it's all remote controlled. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big beast. Yeah. It's a big beast-looking thing anyway. So was the concerns rising over global helium shortage. The third, count them, the third helium shortage in slightly more than a decade has prices soaring faster today than a kid's balloon lost in a windstorm. I like that analogy there.
We seem to have helium shortages regularly often now.
Where do we get helium?
As far as I remember, we get it out of the atmosphere.
Okay.
There may be other ways we can get it, but you can cool the atmosphere and get it out of that. And this is an issue for particularly medical equipment. Helium is used in a lot of that, but also research equipment too. It's a really important thing for keeping things cool around absolute zero temperature. So this happens quite often. The US does have a big stockpile, but they are quite careful with it. I think, what's it called, the National Helium Reserve or something like that. Well, I can't remember. So this is quite difficult. And so as the helium leaks out, because that inevitably is what happens when you have it sort of in these dewars, as we're called, the helium will eventually escape and evaporate away. Then it goes into the atmosphere. But that cycle of not having quite enough at any given time seems to be repeating itself now. So, I don't know. It's a concern, because obviously people who do lots of research, particularly superconductivity researchers, but it's also used in NMR, MRI equipment.
MRIs,
and so on.
Yeah. It says that the fact that the single biggest user of helium are MRIs, which use the liquid form as a coolant. Scuba divers add helium to their tanks when diving to give them greater depths. And of course, there's the helium in the balloons and talk funny and...
Well, that is one of the reasons why the sort of like current research on hot air balloons is going back to hydrogen, even though it's really dangerous because of the shortage in expensive helium right now.
Mm. And there are 14 liquid helium plants in the world.
Okay.
And one is having a problem right now in Qatar, and that's apparently having an impact on the prices as well. Things you learn here on Science Files.
I don't know. It's a concern. Let's put it that way. But I think the U.S. is okay, but they have to be very careful of managing their stockpile.
So. All right. Dr. Rob, the hour flies right by.
Oh, my word. We're already? Wow.
I know. That was a good hour, though. Lots of good questions, lots of good calls. And
I think the black hole's got everyone excited.
I think it does, certainly. I appreciate you dropping by, as always, and we'll see you not next time, but the time
after. Not next week. I'm away next week, but a couple of weeks,
All right. Take care. Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files here on a Monday morning. It is 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off here this morning. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and, well, in our open hours, anything goes, and our phone lines await your calls now. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.